We were asked to assist with the transfer of approximately 4,000 beagles out of a facility called Envigo, which is a breeding facility that breeds beagle puppies so that they can be sold to laboratories in the United States for animal testing.
Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, anthrozoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, for one, I think is off. They're awesome.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
Today is a special episode about the recent removal and rescue of 4,000 beagles from a contract breeding services company that provides beagle puppies to labs to be tested on in the United States. Some of you may have followed this story as it went through the news cycle over the summer. However, I found it a little difficult to wade through the stories about which ex-royals were adopting which beagles and get to the details of what actually happened at this breeding facility and why. So I decided to reach out to my contacts at the Humane Society of the United States and see if I could get some more details. So today I bring you a special episode with Lindsay Hamrick, Director of Shelter and Outreach and Engagement at the Humane Society of the United States. She also previously served as the Director of Policy, Advancing Fair Housing Policies, and supporting humane community cat programs and ending breed-specific legislation. Thank you for joining me as we ask the question, what's the deal with animals? Please introduce yourself and share your pronouns.
I am Lindsay Hamrick, the Director of Shelter Outreach and Engagement for the Humane Society of the United States, and I am a she, her pronoun.
Thank you very much. And what do you do in your work overall?
I always love when titles don't completely reflect the work that people are doing because it's so vast. So at the Humane Society of the United States, there's a couple different buckets that me and my team focus on. The first is we work alongside the animal rescue team to find placement for animals that the Humane Society of the United States is asked to help with. So that could be animals from puppy mills. It could be dog fighting cases. It could be cockfighting cases. It could be a natural disaster where the local shelter is impacted and we need to move homeless pets out of that community so that local pets can be reunited. And the volume of work that entails just depends on how many things are going on and how often the animal rescue team is getting deployed. The second part of our work is mentorship and training for local shelters and rescues. And I can go into a bit more detail about what that means and the areas of focus that we have. But really what we're trying to accomplish is to A, provide some funding and support to local organizations, but also to get some preventative methods engaged at the local level so that this kind of constant intake of animals at shelters and the need to adopt them out starts to be reduced, which of course there's been so much progress made over the last 15 to 20 years in that field. And so each time we sort of meet a benchmark in animal welfare, there's always a new issue that we are recognizing that we're trying to address. So we try to provide some support to local organizations to meet those kinds of demands. And then the third bucket is sort of a free-for-all. So it's just responding to the need that's happening at the local level. It's helping other teams at HSUS to understand what's going on in animal sheltering and in the rescue community. It's serving on some boards that are looking at things like the data in animal sheltering or regional federations of local organizations that have unique challenges to their region. And so there's sort of a other duties as assigned thing, which is a giant box of just things that happen in animal sheltering.
So one of the reasons I asked you to come on for this episode is because of the recent project, the Beagle Project, that has been in the news a lot over the last couple of months. And I'm talking to you now in September 2022, and I'm still hearing a little bit about it on the news here and there, but it seems that this project has now reached its completion. And I wanted to talk to you about what that was and why it was important.
Yeah. So back in early July, we were notified by the Department of Justice and the court system that was working on their lawsuit that we were asked to assist with the transfer of approximately 4,000 beagles out of a facility called Envigo, which is a breeding facility that breeds beagle puppies so that they can be sold to laboratories in the United States for animal testing. Of course, HSUS's work on ending animal testing and on being able to assist with these kinds of transfers is a lot of the reason that we were asked to assist. We have a network of about 400 shelter and rescue partner organizations that are never under any obligation to take animals from our situations, but are the first people we go to when there's a situation like this. Although the Beagle Project, as you called it, was certainly a unique mission for us as well. So it was early July when we were asked, and there were just a huge number of logistical questions and challenges that come into play with a situation like this, because it's very unique in that the animals are not, you know, in a typical animal cruelty situation, law enforcement would seize the animals. The animals would be housed at a temporary shelter, or moved to another facility, and then placed from there, depending on where the court system went. And in this particular situation, you know, the dogs were still living at Envigo as we were moving them out. And so it created a few layers of logistics that were unique to this situation. The court requested that we do this within 60 days, which when I first heard that deadline, I took a deep breath. And, you know, we're motivated to do it quickly as well, because the dogs were living at Envigo, and we knew the standards of care were not ideal. But also moving 4,000 dogs from any kind of situation is a lot. So, you know, we did our best, and we happened to beat that deadline by about 2 days. But I couldn't have predicted that when we first started.
So let me ask you a bit about where this all started. You said it was a DOJ project. They were rescuing or had, I don't know, just talk to me a little bit about where this started, because I think that a lot of people have questions about why HSUS not necessarily was brought in, but why, you know, who actually started this off? You know, who was a whistleblower or put up a red flag that there was a problem here at Envigo? And is that problem now solved?
Those are great questions. So there's quite a bit of history to this facility. One piece of this is that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had inspected Envigo over the years. They were required to be inspected by the government. And there had been multiple violations issued by the USDA against the facility, things like proper veterinary care or temperature control for young puppies, issues that needed to be addressed in order for Envigo to continue producing puppies for the research industry. In addition, there was an undercover investigation done by another national animal welfare organization that, you know, went undercover and did film what was happening at the facility. And that was given to the Department of Justice. So they saw some of that filming as well. And then the reason that this particular transfer happened is because the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against Envigo in late May. The lawsuit banned Envigo from continuing to breed more dogs. So certainly there were pregnant females at the time that the lawsuit went into effect, which is why we had so many puppies that we needed to place, but they were not allowed to continue breeding. And then it took from about late May to early July for the court to figure out what this transfer plan would look like and who would be helping with it, that HSUS would be involved in the transfer. But really, this was a DOJ lawsuit that launched the transfer of this particular group of dogs. Whether or not it solved the problem You know, I guess I would ask the DOJ or the USDA that question. You know, the facility now doesn't have dogs in it. So for that facility and for those specific dogs, of course, this has, you know, the dogs going into families has been a really good outcome for them. But these 4,000-ish beagles at Envigo only make up a fraction of the dogs that are used in animal testing in the U.S. every year. So from our perspective, the fact that they're used at all is still an issue. And we would love to see the day that alternatives to animal testing are fully integrated into the system so that, you know, beagle puppies aren't bred and sold to these labs.
Yeah, that's interesting because my initial thought when I heard about this was that there was some sort of moral outrage against these puppies being bred for lab testing, but that's not the case. The issue is that they weren't being treated well enough within that structure of nonstop breeding and then selling off to labs for research purposes. So there are plenty of other organizations that are still breeding beagles and other animals for lab research. And hopefully this one has been shut down because it was not treating the animals well, but there's plenty more out there. And is there anything that's going to stop this organization from starting back up again?
Yeah. You know, the irony that this facility was shut down because of, they weren't treating the animals up to the code of the federal law. But then the outcome for these animals was going to be lab testing, where certainly they would have suffered in other ways, is a bit ironic. I think a lot of the general public didn't realize that this kind of testing was still legal. So there was sort of a misconception that these particular beagles were already being tested on. But I think the fact that the public is now aware that there are these enormous breeding facilities that whose sole purpose is to provide the puppies to labs has been a real eye-opener for the public. As far as what Envigo can and can't do, I think that the Department of Justice is still, you know, working through all of that through the court system. You know, this facility has been shut down, but whether there's sort of a larger conglomerate of companies that is breeding beagles and whether they can do that in other states. You know, it certainly didn't shut down the entire industry. It was really about the treatment of the beagles at this facility that was in violation.
Yeah, that is really ironic, isn't it? Because yeah, they're going to labs and there are some pretty horrendous things that are still happening in labs and not even just for medical testing, which a lot of people are more okay with than, you know, using animals for, let's say, beauty products testing. But that's still happening too. You know, there's
that's
this
right. And our focus at HSUS is to end the use of animals in cosmetics. That we have a federal bill in Congress that we've worked on for a number of years to ban the use of animals in cosmetics and toxicity testing, which is, you know, typically things like pesticides, testing to see what could be toxic to humans when for decades we have known that these toxins are toxic. So the idea that we would need to keep testing on beagles or other animals to prove that those chemicals are harmful is not only redundant and expensive, but it's also inhumane. And so we also, as part of our campaign to end animal testing, we push a lot on the FDA, Federal Drug Food and Drug Administration, to clarify in their requirements that animals not need to be tested on, because many companies would love to get away from animal testing in toxicity or cosmetics, but because the federal regulations are not crystal clear that they're able to use alternatives, they sort of use that as an excuse or a requirement to keep going. And so we both have this federal law to ban the use of animals in cosmetics testing, but also to urge the FDA to be clear that there are alternatives that could be used.
Yeah, that's really important. Are you guys having to come to grips with ag gag laws and that sort of thing when it comes to videos of these sorts of agencies? Because, you know, there's, as you are very well aware, plenty of inhumane treatment in the agricultural industry of animals, but a lot of that is not seen anymore because of these agricultural bans, laws on people being able to go in and take secret footage.
That's right. So ag-gag laws became more popular probably 10 or so years ago now, when instead of addressing the treatment of animals in factory farms, the industry basically started to punish the people who were highlighting that cruelty by creating these laws that, you know, the whistleblower, the undercover investigator would be held accountable for even finding the evidence. And so HSUS, we've certainly fought against those laws for many years. And, you know, it depends on the state. It depends on the facility. You know, certainly the work that the USDA and DOJ did in this particular situation was critical, because as federal agencies, they have the ability to inspect and oversee some of these licensed facilities, which I think is a little bit different than in factory farming, where, you know, there may or may not be a USDA inspector that's assigned to go in and take a look at how those animals are being treated. And when you look at, you know, in factory farming, there are so few protections for farm animals, whereas in the research industry, those animals are covered under the Federal Animal Welfare Act. And so there are at least some basic standards for how animals should be kept and cared for in a research setting. And so the fact that the USDA and DOJ felt that Envigo wasn't even meeting those basic standards is pretty telling about, you know, the climate and the setting that those beagles were living in.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, from the lawsuit paperwork, you know, things that they noted were, there were about 25 puppies who had died of cold exposure within a few week period, that certain animals weren't receiving adequate veterinary care, that there were things like bite wounds. You know, the dogs were living in kennels together in some situations. And so when a fight would break out and injuries would happen, there were some notes about them not receiving adequate care for that. So, you know, the USDA's job was to document as they inspected some of these violations. And then, you know, the DOJ got involved in order to file this lawsuit and end the breeding that was happening at that and remove the dogs.
And you said they went to a variety of your partners and they've all found homes now, or they've all been at least spread out to organizations that are currently finding them homes.
Correct. Yeah. So we ended up placing with just over 120 shelters and rescues. I think the total number of states was 19 or 20 states. So quite a few states across the country took beagles. And the vast majority have been placed into at least foster homes, if not adoptive homes. We know that there's a backlog of spay neuter appointments right now, and all of these dogs needed that surgery. Many local shelters won't finalize an adoption until the spay-neuter surgery is done. So we know quite a few are sitting in foster homes, but they're in the homes that they're going to stay in until that surgery can be done. So, and of the dogs that might still be waiting, it's a very small handful. We were hearing from partners that they were receiving like 800 applications for 30 dogs. Wow. So we have not had any concerns that the interest from the public was there. And I think, you know, it's so important for the public to realize what an impact they have, because if local shelters and rescues couldn't trust that they would have enough homes, they would not have been able to step up as quickly as they did for us and for these dogs. So when the public really steps in and fosters and adopts, it shows the local community that they can jump into a situation beyond their own community that won't impact the local animals that are also looking for homes. And, you know, certainly we anticipated some of these dogs would have challenges with adjusting to a new home. They've lived in a kennel their whole life. So things like fear-based behaviors, not having like sort of basic socialization, like not having any idea what a television is, how to walk on a leash, house training. What we've heard from partners is that by and large, the dogs have done really well, all things considering. But of course, there will be, out of a group of 4,000 animals, there will be dogs who have some significant challenges. And we're just really grateful both to the partners and to the adopters for working through that, for not assuming that this would be super easy, or that these dogs would come right into their home and look like a normal dog. We did end up pulling more puppies than we anticipated. There was a very large portion of these dogs that were young. And so on the one hand, they have spent critical socialization weeks and months in a facility, which will likely have an impact. But also they didn't spend nearly as much time as some of the breeding pairs. And so the puppies, by and large, seem to be doing pretty well adjusting to life outside of Envigo.
Yeah, that I guess that's expected since they are still in those sort of critical learning periods, and a little bit more sensitive to getting to learn new environments, whereas some of the parents may be a little less so, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, as a behavior person, there's always that genetic resilience that you can't predict, right? So there's going to be some adults who they sort of adjust very quickly to a home, and it's almost surprising. And then there's some dogs who maybe didn't spend as much time at the facility, but are really struggling. And there's lots of reasons why that might be. But, you know, we appreciate everyone's patience as they learn about what the world is out there.
Now, how are the people who ran that facility being held accountable, or do you know?
You know, I don't know the full details. The DOJ, I know they've issued a few press releases as this has gone on in terms of their aspects of this. And so if there were updates on that portion, you know, they would certainly alert the public when that was public information.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I will say, you know, I think that, you know, our perspective at HSUS when it comes to this in sort of industry issue is that we're trying to address the root cause of this, which is an industry that is breeding animals for testing. And while we certainly defer to law enforcement in terms of what they think needs to happen at the legal level, you know, our goal is to get rid of the industry as a whole. And I think sometimes the public focuses so much on the individual people who work at a factory farm or at a research facility. And you know, I hope that folks take a moment to think about how that system is in place in ways that we all as individual people can impact seeing it go away. So, you know, making different choices. And I don't think that all of this is up to consumers. I think there's a huge amount of individual power we have, but really we need to build stronger laws and go after the industry itself. And so that's our long-term goal.
Yeah. Yeah. An important long-term goal. As you say, the individual choices people make are important because that supports some of this going on, but probably less important than people think. Really, what's even more important is where the money goes.
That's
whether
right.
It goes towards or new rules or education, new laws. That's really, I think, where we have to focus.
Sure, absolutely. And when it comes to animal testing, you know, resources towards alternative methods is critical. I mean, there's so much really awesome technology and science that's coming out that provides computer modeling so that we don't need to use animals and we can get a much more reliable outcome. When we're testing drugs, when we're testing toxins, there's just so many alternatives, and that field will continue to grow the more the consumers push back and say, we want something that's less expensive, that's more reliable, and that isn't inhumane.
Yeah, that's important. So do you have any thoughts around how this is going to potentially, just the whole, you know, beagles being sort of top of the media, going to affect things like the puppy mill industry? Are we going to see more beagles on the market in pet stores and on street corners that are really puppy mill broker sort of situations because of this interest in these beagles?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's hard to tell sometimes if the interest is because of the origin story of these dogs or if it's more breed focused, right? I mean, the puppies from this situation were probably the cutest things I've seen in a long time, and I have been around a lot of dogs. So I don't blame the public for being enamored with how adorable they were. And then you add in the situation that they came from. And there's a real motivation to help them. One of the things that we are looking into, we're partnering with Shelter Animals Count, which is a national data collection organization that tries to keep an eye on trends in shelters and rescues. And we're going to do a little bit of a beagle study to find out, number one, did intake of beagles at the shelters that took them help with moving out some of the other homeless pets? And one of my big questions, which we may or may not be able to answer, is everyone who applied for one of these beagles, if you didn't get one, did you go and adopt a different beagle? Because certainly they're not it's not an uncommon breed in the shelter and rescue field. And so, you know, that's sort of the animal welfare side. In terms of whether puppy mills might take advantage of this, I mean, you know, they tend to take advantage of whatever. I don't know that they can trust that the response from the public is because people are really excited about beagles, or if they were just trying to help in this really sad situation. And, you know, puppy mills have been reporting over the last year or so that they are struggling to sell all of the pets, all of the dogs that they're already breeding. So, you know, I guess we'll find out if beagles start to move up on that list.
Mm. Yeah. It's funny that there's a report for puppy mills as well, because it seems like an industry that would be completely unregulated and a lot of backyard puppy mill sort of situations of people just, you know, calling themselves breeder kennels or that sort of thing, and taking advantage of the situation just to, you know, oh, these are beagles that are from this beagle project from the HSUS, and really they're just more beagles bred in the backyard.
Yeah, and I think maybe a piece for the public to keep in mind if that does happen is that the age group of these dogs were already, like, the majority of them were between 8 weeks and about 7 months old. There were quite a few that were adults beyond that. And then we had some nursing litters, but the last litter was born sort of late July. And so if a puppy mill is trying to sell you an Invigo beagle sometime this winter, just by the age alone, a puppy coming from a puppy mill would have not come from Invigo because we've already placed them all. So be mindful, you know, if there's that sort of marketing spin that is put on some of these dogs, you should have paperwork that shows that the animal went through a local animal shelter. And that wouldn't happen because the local shelter is engaging with their adopters if they're struggling and need to rehome.
Yeah. It's really interesting too, what you said about whether other dogs got adopted. If somebody applied for a beagle and didn't get one, which probably happened to quite a lot of people, did they adopt another beagle? Did they adopt another dog completely that wasn't a beagle? Or did they go somewhere else and try to find a beagle at a breeder because they were just interested in beagles in general? Or if more dogs just got adopted over this time period because we had so many more applications.
Right. And we transferred these dogs to a wide array of organizations. So they went to large municipal shelters. They went to small private shelters. They went to breed rescue. So for the beagle rescues that helped us, they of course have lots of other beagles looking for homes. And so were they able to match potential adopters up with the beagles that didn't come from Invigo? That's a data set we'd like to look at. It's been a really challenging, it's been a challenging few years for animal shelters, but certainly this year, we know that many organizations are very full, not necessarily because intake is up, but because adoptions have slowed. And so the fact that we needed to place another almost 4,000 dogs on the system, on the animal welfare system, at a time when there were so many animals in shelters, we really want to know if it helped or not. Or was it just another, you know, 3,800 dogs who needed to find homes?
Yeah. Yeah. Because that could have felt really demoralizing for people in animal rescue, couldn't it? When there's just, you're already working so hard, and then suddenly there's 4,000 more dogs that need homes that you've been trying to find homes for already.
That's right. Yeah, I had a moment in July of, like, moral distress, to ask our partners in what is potentially one of the most stressful summers on record to help with this. And I think they're never under any obligation, but the feedback we got from partners was, yep, it was more work. And of course, like, there's a lot of medical care that needs to be done on these dogs, but it was kind of a nice, not a reprieve, but just a change, just a different group of dogs to work with. I mean, almost none of them had worked with this kind of population directly before. We did work with a number of partners who have helped with beagles removed from other facilities in the past, and they were able to provide some tips and resources to other partners. But overwhelmingly, folks said it was a good experience. And because the dogs were placed so quickly, it didn't put an enormous strain in terms of like space at the shelter that was available.
What other questions are people asking you about this whole endeavor?
I think much of what you've asked in terms of the industry as a whole and sort of what are the next steps from the Department of Justice's perspective. I think for the beagles themselves, you know, many of them have been living in homes now for a few weeks or a few months. And, you know, we're committed to making sure that they're doing okay in the long run. It's for us, it's not just about transferring them to local orgs and hoping for the best. And so, you know, we've been in touch with partners as they've placed the dogs to make sure they have some additional behavioral or medical support, whether that's HSUS reimbursing for some like really expensive medical issues, or if a dog is really struggling in an adoptive home, we have a partnership with Good Pup, which is it's an online dog behavior support service. And so adopters through the shelter or rescue can get some anywhere between 1 and 8 free sessions with a certified professional behaviorist who utilizes methods that we would support. And so there is additional help if folks are struggling above and beyond what the local shelter or rescue could provide, because many of our partners also have really great behavior and medical programs where they may not need that. But we would just encourage, if any of your listeners have adopted a beagle and are struggling, reach out to the shelter or rescue you adopted from first, and then know that we also provide some additional resources if the partner needs that.
Yeah. Now, HSUS in general does a lot of different work. This is just a very small portion of what you guys do. But I know that there's been political spin in the past on, you know, this misunderstanding that the Humane Society of the United States is not actually sheltering animals, which is true. You guys don't shelter animals because that's not what your focus is. Your focus is on supporting the shelters that are doing that work and doing a lot of other work besides. And this just sort of highlights this type of stuff that you do. And when people make donations to HSUS, it is going directly to these projects and to helping animals directly.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an understandable confusion in animal welfare. All of our organizations were formed around the same time. Everybody chose terminology like Humane Society or SPCA or Rescue League and repeated it. And so there are, the best estimate is about 12,000 shelters and rescues across the country. And then when you have national organizations like HSUS and the ASPCA, it can get a little confusing for your average member of the public. And so I know when I used to work in local animal shelters, it was a question we got asked all the time. How are you affiliated? How much money do you get from them? Can they come in and inspect you and investigate you if we don't think you're doing a good job? And so the way that I try to think about it is HSUS, we work on all kinds of different campaigns, whether it's animal research issues, farm animals that are trapped in factory farming, puppy mills, trophy hunting of wildlife. We work a significant amount on policy change, although it's not the entirety of our work. So we are in your state legislatures. We are working on local ordinances or federal laws in Congress to try to address the root cause of some of this. And then our animal rescue team is really positioned to assist when something is larger than any local organization can manage. And then I think about all the tens of, you know, the 12,000 local organizations that are doing that community-based work. And when I think about it from a companion animal perspective, there's such a really beautiful web of resources that are out there now. And during the pandemic, more than any other time in my career, I feel like for the first time, local, regional, and national organizations are talking very consistently. So what am I doing that you don't have to do? You don't have to duplicate effort in this area because we're going to work on this. how can we collaborate together? What coalitions can we form so that we have more impact? And I think animal welfare is becoming more efficient, more effective as a whole, the more that we communicate with one another. We wholeheartedly ask people to support your local shelter or rescue. They are the ones who are helping the pets in your community and probably beyond. So they're helping communities elsewhere as well. And for our work, think of us as the ones that are really focused on the long-term game on some of these issues that may not directly impact your local shelter, and that they don't have the bandwidth to be working on. But all the people that work in animal sheltering care just as much about all those other species of animals, but their ability to expand into those areas as a local organization is limited. And so you do need organizations working at a different level who can stay focused on those things, because we're not taking in animals like an animal shelter would.
Right. Yeah. All very good points. So let's get to questions about you. What's a little bit about your background to start with, and how you came to this work?
Yeah, I think I came to this work the way a lot of people do, which is I was like five and I rescued worms off the sidewalk and I was really weird. And my mom always really supported me in following that passion. When I was growing up, there wasn't really a clear profession for animal welfare. I sort of felt like all of those paths were volunteer based. Like, how do you ever make a living and have a career out of this work? And thankfully, as I went through high school and college, I had professors and mentors who kept offering up opportunities that fit better with where I was coming from. I went to UMass as an animal science student, and most of my classmates were on the vet track. They wanted to go to vet school. I did not. And so I felt a little lost in, okay, if I don't go to vet school, the other thing that was offered to me was working in a research facility. That is, the animal science track tends to be the same folks who go into animal research. And I ended up doing a thesis on the impacts of performing euthanasia, that impact has on laboratory technicians. So I actually interviewed people who worked at a lab that tested on animals and asked them what it was like emotionally. And I think I was drawn to some of that because I've always been really drawn to the people side of animal welfare, like why, whether it's people who work with animals or whether it's the public at large, what does that bond look like and how do we cope when things aren't quite matching up? And then I decided I really loved primates, and I went away to West Africa for 6 months and I volunteered at a chimpanzee sanctuary. And the wildlife advocacy part of me is probably just as strong as the companion animal sheltering work, but I came back from Africa and needed a job and happened to get a job at an animal shelter. And that just started my career in terms of helping the community and understanding the challenges that come with taking care of pets. I adopted a dog. My first dog as an adult had a lot of behavioral challenges. And so, like most dog trainers, I became a dog trainer because I was certain that I could fix him. And so I did not fix him, but I did learn so much about supporting animals behaviorally. And so got my dog training certification, which I've never done anything with for money, but it helps me understand the pets that are coming into shelters or coming in through the animal rescue team. And then I was looking for a change after about 10 years in animal sheltering, and HSUS was hiring a state director in New Hampshire, where I live. I had a degree in public policy, but I didn't understand public policy very well, because I think until you're in politics, it's very complicated. And in some ways, it's intentionally complicated to prevent people from advocating in a very easy way. And so I became a lobbyist through HSUS, working at the State House on things like puppy mills and wildlife protection, which was super cool to develop that skill set. And then just a few years ago, I transitioned into this role, which really married my past experience with animal shelters and my love of that work with the national lens and how we can support them.
Yeah.
So, that's a normal trajectory, right?
Yeah, absolutely. horrifying. It's funny. Everybody comes to it in a slightly different way, don't they? And some of the stories have their similar themes, though, in the interest in animals as a child. But where you go and where you take that to start with and what support you're given as you go along varies mm-hmm. quite a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot of mentors along the way, a lot of doors opening that said, you don't have to go this way. There's another choice over here. So it was as much chance and luck as it was kind of a driven idea.
Let's get to the last three questions, which is, if there was a book you could share with all of the listeners, what would that be?
Oh, gosh, there's so many good ones. Quiet, the book about introverts in this world. Is a favorite of mine. And the reason that it's applicable to animal welfare, working with animals, is that I think, particularly when it comes to advocacy of issues, we assume that extroverts are better at it, that the loud protest testifying personality is the one that will get things done. And I work with lots of extroverts who are very good at their jobs. But introverts, I think there are so many of us who love animals that are drawn to working with them because they don't make us go to parties and talk to us in large settings. And I have a real passion for encouraging people that like to be at home, who like to write, who like to read, to be engaged in this work in the way that is meaningful to them. And that there's so many ways to politically advocate as an introvert. And there are so many ways to help your local shelter and rescue without going in the building and without having to be at special events or fundraising events or things that can be intimidating to folks who are introverts. And, you know, the thing I know most about introverts is that when we have something we're passionate about, a lot of our hesitations or situations that we're not always having a good time in, we sort of set that aside for that passion. So that is the book I would recommend if you haven't read it.
Yeah, I haven't. That sounds really, really great. Because yes, I would definitely consider myself more of an extrovert personality with, you know, the introvert tendencies. But I think that it's true for a lot of people, isn't it? You're not just one or the other sometimes. There's sort of a range. And I think that we could all learn something from both sides of that. How to come to terms with that in ourselves.
Agreed.
Yeah. Would you share a formative childhood memory of a connection you have with animals?
Yeah. It's funny because the things I remember are probably not like the most, it's not like a Norman Rockwell painting when I think about it. But actually the first engagement the first memory I have of the cat that I used to live with is my older brother. We were standing in the kitchen and my older brother was like, "Hey, catch." And he like tossed the cat at me. And then the cat, I still have a scar on my face because the cat like scraped my face. And of course I was young and screaming. But also I look back on how I used to handle animals even through my teenage years, because nobody ever really taught me how to approach and handle animals, or maybe we didn't know back when I was a kid the way we know now. And so I always laugh about kind of how bad I was at it. And so it gives me some grace for people who are having challenges in their home with a pet and their kid has been, you know, hissed at or snapped at. And then, you know, social media loves to blame parents for not being perfect. And I sort of think, oh gosh, you should have seen me with my dog when I was growing up. And that's one of the earliest I remember.
Mm. Yeah, it is funny. I've mentioned before on the podcast just how bad I was with the animals growing up. I always loved them. I always had this connection and wanted to be so close to them and near them, but it was always about me. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't necessarily about what they wanted.
That's right.
Yeah. So what do you think is the deal with animals?
What is the deal with animals? You know, I have this vivid memory in college. I was in a class. I think it was sort of about animal behavior. And the professor wanted us to like research a specific animal, like an individual animal that was famous, and like do a report on why we chose them. And everybody else in my class chose like these sort of veterinary aspect animals. And I chose the gray parrot, Alex, who was taught to speak and like was this huge thing in the animal behavior world. And my professor was like, well, why did you choose, like, why does it matter if Alex can speak English, can say words? And I said, I think that when people see human characteristics in animals, it makes us want to protect them more. I don't necessarily agree that it should work that way, but it seems to that we have a real love for dolphins and animals that look like us, great apes, dogs, and all of their qualities of how they live with us. And I think that people are still figuring out animals. I think that the natural human-animal bond is there. We don't have to force that. But I think culturally, we're still trying to figure out how they fit in our lives and why we treat some species the way we do and not others.
It's a long process. Well, thank you so much for joining me today and answering all my questions that I had about what was going on with the beagles. Because when that first came up in the media, I jumped to all sorts of conclusions about what was happening. And I, you know, realized that I wasn't really getting enough information from the media sources I had. So to be able to ask the questions that I knew that a lot of people had that maybe we just weren't getting all of the answers for.
Yeah, we really appreciate that. It's nice to share the complexity of the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Lindsay Hamrick, Director of Shelter and Outreach Engagement at the Humane Society of the United States. You can find out more about the Humane Society of the United States at humanesociety.org, or for more tools and resources, go to humanepro.org. To see Lindsay's profile and get a link of her book recommendation, go to thedealwithanimals.com and click Guest Profiles. If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com. Leave me a message. I will always read them. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. The Deal with Animals theme music was composed by Kai Stranskoff, and episode editing was Natasha Matzart. Until next time, what do you think is the deal with animals? The Deal with Animals is part of the IROAR Animal Podcast Network.